Good afternoon, it's Matthew Thor from CMU, and he's going to tell us about large data limits for graphical models.
Okay, thank you for the introduction. Thanks to Corolla and the other organisers for inviting me. Okay, so first of all, I just want to acknowledge other people who I've worked with. So Florian Tau is my PhD supervisor at Warwick. Diane Slepchev is my postdoc advisor at CMU. Ricardo is my office mate at CMU. And Matt Dunlop and Andrew Stewart, both of me at Warwick, and have since moved to Caltech. This is also based on joint work with these guys. So the sort of high-level problem is we want to partition a given data set. So this could be classification or clustering, depending on how exactly we set it up. So the idea is then is we use a graph. So Mauro did a good job, I think, in sort of motivating why we want sort of a graphical sort of approach. But the sort of general idea is that we're sort of given a big data set. We have some measure of similarity between data points, and using this measure of similarity, we can construct a graph. Okay, and then so the sort of general methods I'm going to talk about are sort of based around minimizing some objective functional. In particular, these are going to be based on the p-Laplacian and the fractional Laplacian. So the sort of headline is that the dimension sort of matters. So in particular, if we're choosing our p, or if we're choosing our fraction in the fractional Laplacian, one should take into account the dimension of the data when we sort of choose this. Okay, so to sort of quickly recap how we sort of get to our graph. So we start off with a probability measure mu on some space x, which is in Rd. We assume our data points, which are xi's, are sampled from this probability measure, and then these xi's become the nodes of the graph. Between all the nodes on the graph, we connect all the nodes. We connect all the nodes of the graph, and then we weight them with some wij. So this sort of typical, and we assume that wij takes this form here. So this sort of typical sort of example we have in mind is when eta x is 1 if x is less than 1 and 0 otherwise. Okay, what this then means is that these weights are 1 over epsilon to the power of d if xi minus xj is less than epsilon, and they're 0 otherwise. Okay, and then we throw away all the edges with weight zero. Okay, and we should be left with some sort of sparse graph. Okay, so it's sort of the way I've written this. Sort of, you can sort of tell that I'm leading you towards some sort of scaling. So the idea is that as n goes off to infinity, we want to keep our graph sparse. So there's sort of two main reasons why we want to do this. One is for computational expense. That if our matrix, if we have too many edges, any sort of numerical method is probably going to be quite slow. And the second is to increase boundary resolution. So these two pictures here are, we have sort of two classes, and I've chosen epsilon differently in each of them. So in the first one, I've chosen epsilon to be quite large. What this means is we have a lot of edges between these two classes. Okay, because we have a lot of edges, when I've come to applying my sort of classification method, it worked out to be cheaper to cut this class into two here. Okay, this is obviously quite undesirable. In this image here, I've chosen epsilon to be much smaller. Okay, this means actually now there are relatively few edges between these two classes. So when I came to cutting the sort of edges, it was much cheaper to cut them across here. Okay, and this is sort of the sort of nicer image. Okay, on the other hand, if epsilon is too small, well then we're not going to get, well, we're going to have no edges at all, so we're going to have no structure in a problem. So there's a sort of balance between wanting to take epsilon to be as small as possible, but we can't take it too small. Okay, so the objective functionals I'm going to talk about are based around the graph Laplacian. So I'll sort of start off by just defining the L2 Sobolev energy, which is just given by this functional here. Okay, so this functional here, it acts on functions u, which go from the graph onto R. And all we do is we just take the pairwise differences, we square them, and then we weight them with the edge weights. Okay, this relates to the graph Laplacian. So the graph Laplacian is just defined to be, so if W is the matrix of edge weights, D is this diagonal matrix, which, the diagonal is just given by the sum from J to 110, Wij, and then the graph Laplacian is just D minus W. Okay, it's not too important sort of to remember this part here. More important is the sort of relationship here. Okay, and that's that this graph energy can be written as an inner product with respect to the empirical measure. So this is a discrete, this is just a sum with respect to the graph Laplacian here. Okay, I've sort of these SN and SN primes are scaling regimes which are sort of hiding away for now. Okay, so just to sort of recap what the notation is. We assume we're given some set X in RD. We assume we have some probability measure on this space. We assume we have data points which are sampled from this measure, and we have our empirical measure mu n. We have our Sobolev energy, which acts on the graph, given by this term here. Okay, and we have the graph Laplacian, which is related to the Sobolev energy through this inner product. Okay, so the basic questions then I'm going to talk about are, do the minimizers of problems related to this Sobolev energy converge? Can we characterize the limiting problem? And can we find a continuum limit for the graph Laplacian? And then the fourth question is, can we quantify uncertainty? So the dimension really plays a role in this fourth question. I can't answer all the three without really placing any assumptions on the dimension, and it's really the fourth that we have to sort of take this into account. Okay, so the sort of agenda is I'm going to talk briefly about background methods, okay, and then I've got convergence of various different models. I don't think I'll have time to talk about all of them, so I think some of them might end up getting skipped. But I'll start off anyway talking about the graph Laplacian, and then look at the semi-supervised learning model. Quigging and Probit models are just two more models. Okay, the Ginzburg-Landau functional, this is very similar to the phase transition, well, it is the phase transition model we saw in the second talk by Simone. And finally, which I want to come on to, is the probabilistic formulation, where I'll sort of put this graphical framework into probabilistic framework, okay, which then allows to quantify uncertainty. Okay, so gamma convergence was mentioned again in the second talk, and okay, so this is the sort of strict definition of gamma convergence, but the picture is sort of more descriptive in a way. So what we have here is we have a function indexed by n, which oscillates more and more as n increases. So the first observation is that we don't have any strong limit. Okay, clearly it's oscillating, we don't expect a strong limit. Second is we do have a weak limit. So this red curve here is the weak limit, but this doesn't capture what we want to study. So we're looking at minimization problems. The minimum and the minimizers are always sort of around here, but the minimum and the minimizer of the weak limit are always around here. So if we're looking for convergence of minimizers and the minimum, then the weak limit is really the wrong thing to study. The gamma limit is this black curve here, okay, and this is in a way the limiting lowest semi-continuous envelope. Okay, and we can see that this does completely capture the behavior of the minimizers and the minimum. So, okay, and then I have the theorem, okay, which just says what I said in the picture. So that as long as the minimizers un are compact and we have the gamma limit, then the minimum converges, and furthermore the minimizers also converge. Okay, so to talk about convergence of minimizers for sort of graphical models, we need a topology, and this isn't sort of obvious because we're looking at our minimizers are going to be functions on a graph, so this is on a discrete set, but as we get more and more data, we're expecting a continuum object to of appear in the limit. So what we need is a notion of convergence that allows us to compare discrete objects with continuum objects. So this is done using an optimal transport type framework. So the idea is fairly simple. The idea is we just want to take our function, our discrete function on our point cloud, and we want to extend this to piecewise constant functions on the whole set. So we do this by just letting u tilde n be the composition of un with some map tn, which maps from the continuum space onto a discrete case space. So then the question is, how do we choose tn? So it's sort of quite natural to say, okay, we want to choose tn so that it pushes forwards the measure mu onto mu n, okay, and that the distance each point moved is minimized. So this is exactly saying tn should be minimized to Monge's optimal transport problem if you have a background in optimal transport. Okay, so what I sort of said on the previous slide was sort of the constructive way of doing it. Actually, we can sort of write down that this is actually, TL space is actually a metric space. So this is, it's a metric space on couples of functions with a measure. So the idea then is this, instead of comparing functions with functions, we compare functions and a measure with functions and a measure. So so exactly what I said before. So this part here, we say, okay, so we want to minimize this over transport maps, which push mu onto nu, okay, and we want to minimize the distance that this transport map moves, and we also want to minimize the sort of distance between the functions. Okay, there's different ways of writing this down as well. Using, okay, this is the Monge formulation, you can also write this down using the Kantorovich formulation. Okay, so this is very similar to the OT distance. So if I write the OT distance down like this, then you can see that actually, well, if you sort of want to hide U and V in this function C, then it is an OT distance. Okay, otherwise you can see it's just, we just sort of extend it to the functions. Okay, and what I sort of said in the previous slide, okay, so this final point here sort of relates to that. So actually we can say that UN and MUN converge to UMU in TLP if and only if the empirical measure converges weak star, which is true with probability one, and there exists a sequence of transport maps such that this equality here, such that TN converges to identity. So an importance to result, which really gives us the intrinsic scaling in the graph, is the rate of convergence in these transport maps. So this is a result by Diane Slepchev and his former PhD student, Nicholas Lafayette-Trudos. Okay, and what they showed was that TN converges to the identity with rate given by, okay, in the case of D greater than 3, just log n over n to the power of 1 over d. Okay, and this is really sort of, you know, a sharp result, because if we let, if we consider the graph, okay, so if we connect any two nodes that are closer than R, and we let the capital Rn be the smallest R such the graph is connected, then we have that this capital of Rn scales us log n over n to the power of 1 over d. So this scaling here is really just the same scaling that we need for the graph to stay connected. Okay, so with that sort of in mind, let's go on and talk about the convergence of these energies. So this is the sort of LP, Sobolev energy. Okay, so this is the same as I showed you before, except for now I have a P here, okay, and I also have a P here. Okay, so up to a constant then, Nicholas and Diane were able to show that this energy here, gamma, converges to this continuum object infinity, which is just up to a constant, the total variation distance. So this here is just the, well, it's the usual total variation distance, but scaled by rho squared. So okay, to understand this, if u is actually differentiable, then this is actually just the integral of the derivative of u weighted by rho squared. Okay, and they've also been able to show that when p is equal to 2, then the gamma limit of En again converges to just the square of the derivative. And this is sort of natural. I mean, if you look at this function here, then when epsilon goes to 0, then you're expecting this sort of uxi minus uxj over epsilon. Okay, epsilon should give sort of the scale of xi and xj. So this should sort of behave like a derivative. Okay, the 1 over n squared and the sum of from I and j to 1 to n. Okay, that's a double summation. So we're sort of expecting a sort of double integral with respect to the measure mu. Okay, so rho here is just the density of the data. Okay, and this result actually would generalize very easily for any p, not just p equals 2. Okay, so now we can relate this to the continuum operator of the continuum version of the graph Laplacian. So if we sort of recall that the graph Laplacian was related to the Sobolev energy just through this inner product, then if we just substitute this into the previous gamma convergence result, we have exactly this. So this is just the gamma limit of the inner product of the graph Laplacian is equal to this continuum operator here. Okay, very simple sort of rearrangement. We can write this as an inner product with respect to mu, where now we have this continuum operator L, which is given in this form here. Okay, now if we just to compare what we had here to what we had here, we can say, okay, this sort of continuum limit of this graph Laplacian now it should be equal to this continuum operator here. Okay, and okay, so now we have sort of the graph Laplacian, we can sort of look at sort of extending this and looking at sort of fractional versions of it. So if we let lambda I and qi be eigenvalues and eigenvectors of the graph Laplacian, then we can define a fractional graph Sobolev energy just by expanding the, in this form here. Okay, so I include tau here just for sort of slightly more generality. I mean, one can also take tau as equal to zero as well. It's quite convenient when we get to the probabilistic formulation to have tau non-zero, but that we can deal with anything. So this is sort of obviously chosen so that this lambda I here, so that this whole term here starts to approximate the continuum graph Laplacian, the continuum operator, where is it, L. Okay, and so when this is sanity check, when alpha is equal to 1 and tau is equal to 0, then this fractional graph Laplacian up to a constant gives us exactly what we had before. Okay, we can play the same game with the continuum limit. So, okay, so we look at the eigenvalues and eigenfunctions of the continuum operator. Okay, then we define this expansion exactly the same way. Okay, and we have the same sort of sanity check here. Okay, so then the next question would be is, okay, do this fractional Laplacians converge? And okay, and yes, the result is still true. So again, we can show that the gamma limit of these fractional Laplacians is equal to this continuum operator. Okay, and we have this compactness property here, which I won't go too much into. I'll just to say simply is if we can bound the fractional Laplacian, then we have that these UNs are pre-compact. So these sort of two results are sort of ingredients for proving the convergence of minimizers. Okay, so now let's sort of talk about more specific models. So I'll first talk about the semi-supervised learning model. Okay, so this is the objective then is we want to minimize the so this is not in the fractional setting, this is in the sort of LP graph Sobolev energies. So we want to minimize this LP Sobolev energy subject to u taking values at certain points. Okay, so this is sort of a hard constraint problem. Okay, and I can sort of redefine this minimization problem just sort of more conveniently as minimizing Fn, okay, where Fn is equal to En if the restraints are satisfied and infinity elsewhere. Okay, so clearly sort of minimizers to this problem here are equal to minimizers of this problem here. Okay, so now if we assume we have labels for the first of capital N data points where capital N is going to be fixed, okay, then it's kind of obvious what's going to happen. So if P is bigger than D, where D is the dimension of the space, we know that, we're sort of expecting our minimizers should be in this sort of space W1P. Okay, we know that W1P is going to be, function of W1P will be continuous, so we know it makes sense to condition on points. Okay, this isn't true if P is less than or equal to D, then the constraint set doesn't really make sense. So this is exactly what we see in the limit. So if we say that UN is a minimizer to this constraint problem, then UN will converge in TLP to a minimizer of F infinity defined by if P is greater than D, then the continuum limit respects the constraints. So it just minimizes E infinity subject to the constraints. If P is less than or equal to D, then minimizers of these UNs will converge to minimizers of F infinity, which is just equal to the sort of E infinity. So there's no constraints in this case here. Okay, and this is just a little video which sort of shows you sort of what happens. So the precise setup is actually slightly different from what I'll sort of say, but okay, what you should think about is that, okay, we've labeled a subset of the data. So all the data in this circle here has been labeled 1, all the data here has been labeled -1, and we have no labels elsewhere. So the objective then is to find all the labels outside these two sets. So this now shows what would happen when P goes to when P is decreasing. So what we see is that initially, let's wait for it to start again. Okay, so initially we have quite a sharp sort of boundary here. So basically everything here has been labeled +1, everything here has been labeled -1, and we have some sort of fairly sharp boundary where we go between the two classes. But as I sort of run this forwards, what we sort of see is that it becomes sort of flatter and flatter around here. So actually the sort of phase transition is actually at alpha is equal to 1. So now we see, now this is looking very, very flat. Okay, so we see really we only have sort of very close here, we're labeling -1, and very close to here, we're labeling +1. Everything else is actually very close to 0. Okay, as we go on, okay, we see that once we get sort of down to the limit, oh, I just missed it. Okay, so in the limit, then really all we've done is label +1, -1 here, +1 here, and we label everything else being 0. So we have no sort of information. Okay, how long do I have left, by the way? 15 minutes. Okay, I should have time to talk about the Kriging and Probit models. Okay, so this is almost a sort of recap of what I just said. So we looked at convergence of the sublevel of energies and the fractional sublevel of energies. Okay, but obviously in applications, this actually isn't useful at all because minimizers without the further constraints and further terms are just going to be trivial, just constant functions. Okay, so we've also considered the semi-supervised learning problem, which had a hard constraint. Okay, this means you have to really trust the data, and clearly this isn't always going to be the case. Sometimes the data you get isn't going to be, you're not going to trust, so you want to do things, for example, with a soft constraint. Okay, so the question is, what are the models? Are there? Okay, so I'm sort of going to show you two other models, which are called the Krigging model and the Probit model. So the Krigging model is basically the semi-supervised learning with a soft constraint. And the Probit model, I'll sort of explain what it is very shortly. Okay, and what we don't want to have to do is redo everything we've just done for the convergence for these new models. So the idea then is that to show the convergence, we really want to take advantage of the stability properties of gamma convergence. So, okay, so the Krigging model probably doesn't really need much motivation. It's really just a semi-supervised learning with the soft constraint. So now we assume that we have data of, okay, at points xi, we have data y xi. Okay, and now we fit this sort of soft constraint here where we say that yxi okay, minus uxi squared, this should be, want this to be small. Okay, and we define these objective functionals. So again, I've done this in terms now of the fractional sublevel of energies. I mean, one can also do this again with the other, the sort of LP sublevel of energies as well. Okay, and then the limiting objective functionals are defined sort of similarly, where now it's okay, now we're sort of integrating over a region. So I'm assuming the data now comes from, I can probably just. So if I have my set X, I'm assuming that I have a sort of subset of this X prime, okay, where I know what the, where I have labels. Okay, and then the convergence again passes straight through. So now I have, I can say that minimizers of, where is it? Okay, minimizers of this the Krigging model are both pre-compact and converge to minimizers of this sort of infinite problem. And the proof is very sort of straightforward. One uses the result that gamma convergence is stable with respect to continuous convergence. So continuous convergence just means that if un converges to u in our topology, which in this case is TL2, then we have that these sort of additional sort of fidelity terms also converge. Okay, and if this is true, okay, then the gamma convergence passes straight through. Okay, and we already have the compactness from the directly from the fractional graph Laplacian. Okay, so the second model I'll talk very briefly about is the Probit model. So, okay, so the motivation for this is we suppose we're given we want to estimate y, u given y, and we assume that you know that u should take the values either plus or minus one. Okay, and we assume this following model. So we assume that y is equal to the sine of u plus some noise. So, okay, so we have delta, which is the standard normal. Okay, we scale it by gamma. Okay, and then if u plus gamma times delta is positive, then we say that y is equal to 1. If u plus gamma times delta is less than 0, we say it's minus 1. Okay, so it's a very small amount of algebra then to show that the probability of y given u is just equal to psi times psi applied to u times y, where psi of u is the cumulative distribution function of a centered Gaussian with a standard deviation gamma. Okay, so this sort of motivates this sort of model here. Okay, now where we're taking our sort of extra sort of fidelity term now is equal to okay a sort of discrete integral times the log of psi of y times xi uxi. Okay, so this is sort of almost a Bayesian sort of approach where we sort of think about this. We think of a sort of Jn as being related to the prior, and we think of this fidelity term here as being related to the likelihood. Okay, the scalings aren't quite right for it to be a sort of true Bayesian. It's more sort of convenient Bayesian sort of approach. Okay, and again, the continuum model again is just the natural one where, okay, we just replace the fractional energy with the limiting fractional energy. Okay, and then this fidelity term we just replace with a sort of an integral where we have summations before. Okay, and again, we have the same theorem we had with the probit model. Okay, now where we say that minimizers of the probit model are converged to minimizers of the limiting model, and the proof is sort of almost exactly the same. Again, we're taking advantage of sort of continuous convergence and the stability of gamma convergence. There's one sort of slight additional complication where it's not sort of, at least I don't think it's sort of obvious that this term here, that if U is in L2, that this term here will be finite, but it's okay, one can sort of bound things and do a little bit of computation and show that it is always finite as long as we're in L2. Okay, so now I can talk about the Ginzburg-Landau functional. So we've sort of already seen this model in Simone's talk. So again, I can probably explain this fairly briefly. So the first term here, we have our sort of double well potential. So the idea is we want, we're given a data set and we want everything to either be in a plus or minus, to label everything either plus or minus one, but we're not going to sort of enforce this directly, rather we're going to penalize when we're not in plus or minus one. So we do this through a double well potential. So you can see that at plus or minus one, this potential takes the value zero. So we have no cost here. So everything minimizes are going to want to take minus one or plus one. Okay, and then we have this sort of, this is again just the LP stop of energy. Again, and this is sort of trying to penalize the gradients. And one can do sort of similar things as we've seen previously by adding sort of more fidelity terms if we have data, for example. Okay, so I wanted to explain how I did this. I'd rather just to show you the video of how to sort of segment this this cow. So I think I start off by labeling, I can't remember how many points, maybe something like 10 points. So I think I label 10 points sort of green, which are the background, and I label a few points red, which are on the cow. And then I basically just start my method off. And what we used to see is that initially, okay, so the color, it should restart in a sec. Okay, so what we sort of have initially is, so this color blue means we sort of think it's the cow, but we're not too sure. This yellow means we think it's background, but again, we're not too sure. And as we sort of run it forward, we sort of see that we sort of expand out from the points which I've sort of labeled, and we sort of get more and more sure. So we sort of see this sort of green ring here, which means, okay, we sort of think it's the back, well, we're pretty sure it's the background. Okay, here we're sort of misclassifying, but eventually we sort of get, it retreats. I don't think it retreats all the way, actually. But okay, it's quite a nice video. Right. Okay, yeah, and I should also sort of point out, so Carola's also done sort of work in this area, and I think you have much better code than I do. Okay, so again, so looking at the sort of asymptotics, so when p is equal to 1, we define this functional here. So we're now in the, okay, so before we were in the isotropic setting where these weights were assumed to depend on the distance. Okay, now we're going to relax this assumption and just these weights can also depend on the direction between the two nodes as well. Okay, in which case we get if the limiting problem essentially is going to be a surface energy. So what we have is that this energy G, okay, is infinite if U doesn't take the values plus or minus one everywhere. If it does take the values plus or minus one everywhere, then we can sort of define this set here, okay, which is just the bound U where U is equal to one. Okay, then we have, okay, so N is just the normal vector for the surface. Okay, and then, sigma is, okay, I guess sigma, maybe it's hard to sort of understand without some making further simplifications. So sigma, if we're in the isotropic setting, this sigma actually just becomes a constant, so it doesn't depend on the normal vector. It just accounts for directions if we're in sort of an isotropic setting. Okay, and then this sort of rho squared again is just because we have this sort of double summation. So it's sort of, I mean, if we look at the discrete problem, it's sort of perhaps obvious what we sort of expect to get out of it. That this term here is just going to force everything to take plus or minus one because we're scaling by one over epsilon. And this term here just starts behaving a bit like a derivative, but with the sort of loss of compactness, we end up with in a sort of bounded variations rather than a subnormal space. Okay, and then this result here by myself and Florian, okay, just says that the gamma limit of this Gn is this limiting energy here. Okay, and then we have this sort of compactness properties. Okay, so this was when p is equal to 1. When p is greater than 1, we have this result here, okay, which is basically the same except for we have a sort of additional sort of dependence on p. Okay, and perhaps more importantly, we have this extra constant here, which depends on the double well potential. So on the previous slide here, this limiting problem here did not depend on the double well potential. So you're free to choose whatever double well potential you want, and the limit, it will have no effect. Once p is bigger than 1, then this double well potential does play a role. It comes out as a constant. Again, it's still a surface energy, and up to sort of these additional factors of 1 over p, it is the same same result. So, okay, so Yves van Gennep and Andrew Bertozzi, they also have a very similar result when p is equal to 2, and this is on regular graphs. This is all still on the point cloud, not on the regular graphs. Okay, so I can finally talk about this probabilistic formulation. So I'll go very quickly here. So the key idea then is we define a sort of prior, which is related to the graph Laplacian. So we use so the prior is just going to be center Gaussian, okay, with this covariance operator here. We take some sort of a likelihood, which for example could be the Kriging penalty, could be the Probit penalty, could be the Ginzburg-Langdon penalty, or you know, however you're sort of building your model. Okay, and we define this distribution sort of nu n just to be okay e to the minus pi n times our prior. Okay, and the idea then is that sampling from okay, so maximizers of this okay or the mean is going to be the solutions to our variational problem we've had before. But now what we can do is we can sort of also sample from this. So we can and because we can sample from this, this now gives us a way of quantifying uncertainty. Okay, so I have sort of a video. Okay, this was actually made by Andrew Stewart. So this actually is in the continuum case. So what he did was he took rho, which had sort of high density in two ellipses. He conditioned on taking the value, I think, plus one here, minus one here. And then he sampled from this distribution. Okay, so what you see here are samples. What you see here is the sign of the sample. So when, if I pause this a sec. So when this here is going, is, okay, so when a pixel is less than zero here, okay, we color it blue, and when, okay, and vice versa. On this side here, we keep a running average of the samples, of the sign of the samples, and here we keep a running average of the samples. So what we see is, even though we never put in that we should have like, we're expecting our sort of boundary between the two classes to be sort of ellipsoid, this is what we get. That's our sort of final sort of result. Okay, so the continuum limit, again, we define this in the same sort of way. So we take our prior is a centered Gaussian with the covariance given by the sort of continuum limit of the graph Laplacian. We haven't proved this rigorously that we do get convergence to this, that our discrete our posterior converges to our continuum posterior, but this is sort of work in progress. Okay, but let me sort of remark that again, for this continuum Gaussian to be well defined, again, we need to choose alpha to be bigger than d over 2. When alpha isn't bigger than d over 2, then this is sort of ill-defined, okay, and our sort of Bayesian approach sort of collapses. Okay, so this, again, so this actually is the experiment that I sort of showed earlier, but I've included some additional figures. So again, this is, so for our, okay, so we need alpha to be bigger than d over 2. So in this example, d is 2. So we need alpha to be bigger than 1 for our posterior to be well defined. Okay, so we labeled data plus 1 here, minus 1 here, and had no labels in between. Okay, again, this is the same figure we had before. So we sort of see when alpha is quite big, we get sort of very clear boundaries. When alpha is sort of small, we get none. Okay, and if we also keep track of the pointwise variance, what we sort of see is that, okay, we start off with around 0.1. And again, we're sort of increasing. Okay, and then as we sort of hit the limit, so once alpha is equal to 1, it's ill-posed. So now we really start to see the variance blowing up. Okay, but actually the sign of the mean stays fairly well behaved. So our sort of variational problem really doesn't really sort of well behave, and we sort of don't notice if we don't consider the sort of Bayesian sort of framework that actually our posterior is blowing up and things are becoming not so good. Okay, this is sort of a similar sort of experiment where we've got some labelled data. Okay, now we sort of fixed alpha is equal to 1 and we just move the labelled data around the domain. Okay, again, so this is alpha is equal to 1, so we see the variance. This is at the sort of critical point. We see the variance is probably sort of around maybe 3. It's sort of quite flat between the two areas, but not too bad. If I do the same for alpha is equal to 2, okay, our variance is now much, much lower, around 0.6. And again, this sort of boundary here is much, much sharper. Okay, so I just flash some references quickly and finish.
Krieging model, is this the same Krieging as in the Krieging algorithm for sonar data? Has it got anything to do with it?
I don't know. So actually, I never heard the name Krieging until maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago.
A really famous method for analysing sonar data.
I think it might come from this. Yeah, I think it came from geophysics. It's where I think, okay, so it probably is the same thing, but I have to say I don't really know too much about kind of the name.
I have a question about these convergence results that you have.
Yeah.
So you're using, in particular in the first gamma convergence results, the limit density of your function. So what can you say about the discrete density of the graph? If you estimate it on an epsilon ball, is it enough to have the convergence of this density to the limit density, or do you need something which is rather epsilon 0 to a square or square root of epsilon.
Are you asking is can we get away without having sort of densities and just having...
I'm just asking, so anyway, you have the density because you're assuming that if there is uniform control of your energies, then there is a convergence to a limit function which has a density, and you can use this density to evaluate the limit energy. Fine. My question is more about the estimation of the discrete density of your graphs, and whether you can use the same neighborhood to estimate, I mean, a neighborhood whose radius is related to epsilon in some way.
I don't know. I think this is something that I've been thinking about as well. Okay, so a lot of the advantage of knowing what the continuum limits are is that if you know what the continuum limits is, then you don't have to, let me just go back to where something like... Okay, so, I mean... So the advantage of knowing what the sort of continuum is that you now, so the way these numerical experiments were actually done is we didn't calculate the eigenvalues and eigenvectors of the discrete problem. We calculated the eigenvalues and eigenvectors of the continuum problem, which is much sort of easier because now we no longer have to compute these sort of graph Laplacians, which could be, if you have a million data points, it could take you just a long time just to even do the pairwise distances. So so the natural question is actually can we, okay, of course in real application you don't know what the density is. So the question then is, can you sort of just substitute in the an approximation for the density into this? So this is something, so I have tried this, but I only tried this very briefly, and I got terrible results. But I think this might be my coding rather than an actual problem in the method. But yeah, this is what we're...
Due to the choice of epsilon.
Yeah, so I mean, the way I think about this was, I guess I was having two parameters, like I had my sort of sound, and then I had sort of another parameter which sort of controlled the ball that I looked in. And I was thinking about these things in terms of mollifying, which I think when I mollify things, I think they're becoming too lumpy, and I think this really sort of, this meant that things didn't really work well. I would imagine there's probably going to be a second scaling regime where you have to look in some ball, which is probably going to have to scale very slowly compared to epsilon again, with my intuition, but I don't. This is something that I'm also thinking.
There are people interested in these discrete eigenvalue eigenvectors, like Bornstein brothers, Max Oxyev, etc. They need this kind of information.
Yeah.
Is it interesting to also look at higher order energies, higher order derivatives?
So this is kind of what these the fractional plastic is. Okay, so when I have alpha, I'm always thinking of alpha being quite large.
Okay, so alpha can be.
Yes, in some ways, like when alpha is equal to 2, okay, it's not quite the second derivative, but it's almost the second derivative. I mean, if you wanted to really have the second derivative, then I guess you can't look at pairwise distance anymore. Instead, you could look at sort of triplets, which would probably be, okay, so I think these are hypergraphs, okay, which is not something that I've looked into, but I think, you know, this is probably, yeah, so instead of having sort of Wij, now you have Wijk, and somehow you're looking at sort of triplets. So I'm not quite sure how you would write this down, but...
Yeah.